Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:18 p.m. and that is Pacific Summertime, and today is March 5th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off with the yield curve spread because it's up to 142 basis points. We can definitely see that there is a cyclicality here. It does tend to go up and down a lot, and then there are clear trends. We had an incredible wobble back around the late 1970s because of the savings and loan crisis. Since the early 1990s, every time there's a recession, there has been an inverted yield curve before it. Subsequently, as the yield curve starts to really steepen, it usually occurs because the Federal Reserve in the USA is a little bit late in lowering interest rates and responding to the deterioration in the economy. So you generally then tend to see the yield curve spread rising rather quickly during the worst periods of a sell-off. That was certainly true in the early 2000s. It was certainly true in the period from 2007 through to 2009. But then it's quite different now, because they acted very quickly in terms of dealing with the risk from the pandemic. So interest rates fell aggressively, and now we're well into a recovery, and the yield curve spread is only now just beginning to advance. So the argument is, the big argument now is that we've already had the recession, we've already had the big pullback, and now we're well into the recovery, and bonds are just responding in a laggard manner. So the yield curve spread is definitely still trending higher. There is absolutely no question about that. The pace of the advance continues to rise, and it is asking big questions about bonds. So we can then think about, well, how are different bond rates doing? The 5-year in the USA has clearly broken out, and it was in positive territory again in here today. And while off the highs for the day, then the big question is, what happens next? Do we get a reversion back down to the mean? Will this 80 basis point level encourage buyers back into the market? There's certainly the potential for that. Because when we think about what's happening around the world, well, we've had incredible commonality in terms of the sell-off for the sovereign bond markets. So the gilt yield has also popped on the upside and has begun to pause around these levels. When we think about the Australian government bond, we've also had this really very exaggerated breakout. So it's certainly in the English-speaking world that we're starting to see the clearest evidence of reticence to buy bonds and the willingness to give some credence to a return to inflation. Canadian bonds have rallied 100 basis points in lockstep with the USA over the course of the last 6 months as well. We haven't had quite the same move, for example, with the Swiss 10-year. It's right about testing the upper side of this range that's been forming for the last year, but it was in positive territory today. So this is the big question. What are governments going to do about this rising yield? There are a couple of reasons why the yield is rising. The first is growth. It's very simple that we are back on a recovery trajectory. The vaccines work. I think that's clear. It's been a massive proof of concept for the biotechnology sector. Biotechnology has done really rather well over the last 12 months, and we've had a rather sharp pullback. So this is an additional thing that, if we had to just pick one word for how to characterize everything that's gone on over the last 3 weeks, it's mean reversion. There would be a temptation to think that it's the end of a bull market, but that's, I think, probably unlikely. What we're instead seeing is clear evidence of a very large rotation out of the winners from 2020 and into more reflation candidates. The biotechnology sector pretty much treads a fine line between the two, because the big proof of concept for genetic solutions has been really a game changer for the sector. They can now argue that genetics really does work. It has real-world applications. It's greatly accelerated the commercialization of the strategies. So this probably is not much more than a mean reversion, and we did see some evidence of support being found in here today. Then when we think about some of the SPACs, well, this isn't quite the same thing. There are a lot of these companies that have used the opportunity of a massive availability of liquidity and real appetite for by investors for speculative ventures to go off and list their companies. I am rather reminded by just one episode that when StockCube Research acquired Fuller Money, then they were in the process of listing their shares on the LSE, or in the AIM index, I should say, back in 1999. And it was very clear they were selling the company for more than it was worth. It was highly successful. They got £4 million into the bank. The share lost about 90% of its value, and then it was taken private, probably about 15 or 16 years later. And we're starting to see that other newsletter writing companies have just signed up for SPACs in the order of about 500 million over just this week. So there's certainly an incentive for companies to sell at these really quite exaggerated valuations, because the best time to sell your company is when you think you can get more for it than it's worth. And when somebody says that the addressable market for newsletters is $190 billion, well, I would question on what planet. So obviously there is some exaggeration going on here. We've definitely seen a significant pullback, but today we had an upside Q reversal on the SPAC index. So there is certainly the scope that even with a modest pause in the pace of bond yield appreciation, then there is a willingness to wade in and buy the dips. The main Wall Street indices bounced rather well in here today. So the S&P 500, for example, was up nearly 2%. The Nasdaq, which had been pulling back more aggressively, was also in positive territory. When we then think about some of the more over-levered parts of the Nasdaq, well, Tesla, for example, has now just about unwound its overextension relative to the trend mean, and it was off its lows in here today. There will certainly be people thinking about buying the dip, but anyone who's buying the dip would surely be looking at the kind of volatility we've had over the last 7 days. There have been extraordinary pops on the upside in just very short periods of time, and it's a rather odd situation overall that you would have this kind of volatility that's going completely unremarked. It's either that Bloomberg has got bad tick data, or there are some rather big shenanigans going on in the background of Tesla trading. But it's come back from 900 to 600, so this is a meaningful pullback. It's in the region of the trend mean. It's bounced today at least from above the 500 level and the region of the September peak, so it's a natural area where we might see some support starting to come through. We're starting to see a lot of evidence of that everywhere. So the biotech sector has bounced from the region of the trend mean. Tesla is coming back there as well. There are other companies like Google, for example, that have not pulled back to the same extent and did also rebound in here today. But there is a big delineation between the tech companies with solid earnings and those that are heavily dependent on access to cheap liquidity. So this access to cheap liquidity question is one of the big things that need to be addressed. Bull markets thrive on liquidity, and they thrive on big stories. So Obviously, there are some companies that did exceptionally well in 2020, Zoom Media being one of them. And the share is now giving up a good portion of the advance. Yes, it steadied somewhat in here today, but it's hard to argue why Zoom is going to be able to sustain its growth rate from 2020 in the future. That's equally true of the broad cloud computing sector. And it's also been pulling back, and we're due some consolidation. Cloud computing companies were able to pull forward sales from years in the future into 2020. It's just inconceivable that they're going to be able to sustain those growth rates in the coming years. As we move increasingly towards a point where vaccines are being rolled out, herd immunity is being achieved, by the time we get into the summer months, there are likely to be very significant portions of the populations in the developed markets, at least, who have been vaccinated. And the number of vaccines being produced is going to multiply. We saw in here this week that Johnson & Johnson had their single-shot solution permissioned. And the share has also pulled back to the region of the trend mean and begun to demonstrate support in the region of that the upper side of that three-year range. So as we look towards the middle of this year and later this year, obviously, we're going to have more vaccines produced. There will be more vaccines permissioned, and anyone who wants one will get one. We might even enter a situation where, in order to travel, you might be that airlines might insist on you having one, or countries might insist that any visitors to there would be inoculated before travel. Obviously, there is going to be a lot of disquiet about that kind of forceful vaccination, but nonetheless, anyone who wants one will have one made available to them by this time next year at the absolute latest, and quite likely by the summer months for the majority of the G7. Well, that means then that people's fear about going out will abate. Certainly, the trip that we had to Texas and the last couple of weeks was a bit of an eye-opener. Obviously, when we think about of course, every single person in different parts of the world will have had a different experience with lockdowns. One of the reasons why California's lockdown didn't work, the fact that they locked down and then cases continued to rise, is because they nominated nearly 55% of the population as an essential worker. And when you've got more than half of the people who are not engaged in a lockdown, how on earth is it supposed to work? But it's these kinds of logical inconsistencies have characterized the response to the pandemic all over the world. But one thing I found really interesting about visiting Texas is that when you look at the headlines, then anyone would be given to understand that nobody wears masks, whereas it's exactly the opposite. Everywhere we went, people were wearing masks, but you can still eat indoors. You can still sit down to eat. You don't have to wear a mask when you're indoors. Everywhere was very well ventilated. Lots of restaurants, the vast majority, were practicing social distancing in a very disciplined manner. And they've been successful in containing the number of cases, primarily because they haven't excised 55% of the population from obeying the mandate. So these are, I think, some of the important points that we're likely to, and something that we definitely saw in Texas, was that people seemed to be much happier. They seemed to be out and enjoying themselves more and enjoying restaurants. And that is despite the fact that unemployment is still very high. And also that a lot of people are still suffering unduly from the lockdowns. So it's very likely that just the simple reality that human beings are social animals and that we crave social interaction is going to mean that once lockdowns end, people are going to surge back into social activity. That's likely to greatly enhance demand for just about everything, but it's less likely to be a benefit to those companies like Zoom, where people have been forced to use their products. And there will be plenty of those types of companies will certainly come under duress. Obviously, when we then think about how successful the IPO sector has been, it was also well off the lows in here today. So this looks like a mean reversion, and we've had the mean reversion. We're starting to see the first evidence of support starting to come back in. So it's a clear area where some people will certainly be looking to buy the dip. It is also worth reminding ourselves that some of these sectors are very interest rate sensitive. If we think about secular bull markets, then you need a big story. And the big story that is clear is we've got reflation. Reflation is something that is starting to push bond yields higher. And bonds now at 1.57% on the 10-year are very oversold, so we're quite likely to have a buying opportunity from the perspective of fixed income investors. The dollar index has popped on the upside in here today again, so it has now pushed on to new recovery highs. It hasn't traded at this level since back in November, and it is likely to continue to rise until we see clear evidence of stress starting to come through in the bond markets. Now, if bond yields rise without any kind of intervention by the Federal Reserve or other central banks, if bond yields start to come back down, I should say, then the dollar can continue to rally. Other currencies should also steady because there isn't a massive new supply. But what I rather think of is it's really about big stories. And when we think about the stock market overall, when we think about the copper market, for example, copper miners have continued to also move through a process of mean reversion, but it's been comparatively shallow so far. So it is still very much a bull market environment. When we think about what are the plans for the next decade? Well, we need a lot of infrastructure. We certainly need a lot of energy or electricity generating capacity, batteries, electric motors, electric vehicles, wind turbines. All of these are significant trends. The wind and solar sectors pulled back very sharply as interest rates started to rise. And now they are right in the region of their respective trend means as well. We had these extremely exaggerated advances. We've had equally extreme pullbacks. So now the question is this the extent of the mean reversion? Are we due a bounce? I suspect we are due a bounce. So this is likely to be a buying opportunity for at least some of the trends that have got a secular tailwind behind them. The outlook for the battery sector, for battery metals, is certainly something that is gaining attention because it has legs, it has a future in front of it. The Norilsk Nickel, which is the largest nickel producer as well as a big platinum and palladium producer, is now right back in the region of its trend mean as well. When we think about some of the more speculative sectors, but that still have the runway for additional upside. Well, we've had a meaningful pullback in the Alternative Harvest ETF. It went from 10 to 35, now back to 20. So this is a potential area of support. There is obviously a clear delineation between those that were flashes in the pan and the best performers from back in 2020. If we look at the value growth ratio, then I think we have a graphic representation of what that looked like. Growth massively outperformed in 2020, and that growth is not as compelling anymore because of the interest rate sensitivity. Value stocks, on the other hand, they tend to thrive when there's a discount rate. In fact, they need a discount rate to justify the determination of what represents value. The big sectors that represent value are the oil sector, banks, and the pharmaceuticals. Oil prices continue to rebound, and we're up an additional nearly $3 in here today, so now right in the region of the levels that prevailed before the pandemic in early 2020. OPEC announced this week that they are going to continue to curtail supply. And that's really great news from the perspective of oil investors, because it's going to enhance the limited supply argument. As we look towards where are additional new barrels going to come from into the market, it's not too difficult to think about where that might be. As the price has rallied almost $5 in here over the course of the last 2 days, well, now it would be possible to hedge production out to January 2023 at about $60. And there is a lot of oil is economic at $60. So this is still a bull market. It takes about 3 months for new supply to hit the market once drilling programs start. Higher interest rates might delay the whole thing, because companies have to go out and source the funding to engage in the more expensive hydraulic fracturing enterprises. And certainly, oil prices have surged higher of late, so we are looking at an increasingly overbought condition. I rather think that it's unlikely we're going to see the $80 level surmounted, but as we move into more of a reflation environment and the pace of the economic revival picks up, the surprises are likely to be on the upside. When we look at the London Metals Index, it has clearly broken out, but is susceptible to some pause and consolidation. When we think about the agricultural sector, agricultural commodities continue to be quite firm. The Wisdom Tree Futures ETF, or ETC, it has clearly broken its downtrend. Now, it's obviously got futures, so it tends to underperform on the way down because of the contango cost. So it takes a meaningful move for it to rally enough to break its downtrend. And it's still pushing higher. If we look at some of those individual food commodities like soybeans, it has very clearly broken out of a well-defined base formation, and it was in additional positive territory in here as well today. Corn prices were quite volatile this week, but they are also firming and above that 500 cent level. These are key food commodities, and whereas central banks don't measure commodity prices when they're looking at inflation, people feel that in their pocketbooks. Corn, soybeans, rough rice are the kinds of things that people buy on a weekly basis. And we are continuing to see that strengthening prices are both a reflection of rising inflationary pressures and a response to the supply disruptions that we had in 2020. I think one of the biggest challenges for all investors is placing any kind of reliance on economic statistics, because as we move progressively through a full 12-month circle from the beginning of the pandemic, then economic comparisons on a year-over-year basis are going to look really loopy, because we had these incredible divergences. When, for example, we look at the average hourly earnings, well, they surged higher when we had the pandemic, because so few people were working. It greatly exaggerated the number, and then it came rattling back down. Now, Are people really getting a 5% pay rise in February over January? I think it's unlikely. I think these data points have been greatly exaggerated because of the fall off in the number of people working. Well, payrolls did rise more than expected in here this week, and they're probably going to do better again in March as economies open back up. We're likely to see unemployment come back down rather quickly. People really want to get out of the house. They want to get back to work. They want to re-engage with their lives, and they're going to do that in a hurry. So that is likely to spur interest in all manner of social activities. When we think about the big decline that we saw in Marriott, it has now rebounded and is right in the region of the peak from back in 2020. All you have to do is look at some property websites. There are large numbers of hotels that are for sale. There are significant numbers of commercial properties that are really at bargain basement prices. The number of when we think about, for example, property groups like Simon Properties, they collapsed over the last few years and really accelerated lower in the early part of 2020, but now they're back on a recovery trajectory, and they have significantly streamlined operations. Westfield was part of a shotgun wedding with Uniball Redinco, and the share collapsed also in 2020, and it is now firming from the region of the trend mean, where they have also massively streamlined operations. So if we are looking at a swifter recovery, then some of these companies that have come through the crisis are likely to benefit because they'll capture market share. And that's one of the big takeaways. They have a runway of growth ahead because they were priced as if they're going to go out of business. Then we can think about companies where all of their value is in their real estate, like Macy's. It's rather difficult to predict that they're going to be one of the big leaders coming out of this because they were already on the cusp of failure and had failed to migrate to the online marketplace ahead of the crisis, and they haven't done a very successful job of doing it on this occasion either. So there are definitely going to be winners and losers from this migration, that people are going to simply move back into a more active life. Then there will be clear government efforts to try and get as many people back to work as possible. And governments all over the world are adopting green mandates. It's one of the few sectors that has got very little in the way of competition, and that everybody wants to get in on this act. That fear of global warming and the desire to be energy independent, these are some of the big factors in terms of this demand cycle. So we're likely to see a lot of investment in renewable energy because there is this energy independence motive. One of the primary reasons why people are interested in things like cryptocurrencies is because of that financial independence motive. And Bitcoin was up today about $1,200, so it continues to hold this range that's been forming now for the last 3 or 4 weeks. This range is above the last. It's still a reasonably consistent trend overall. We look at it on a log scale chart, which I think is the most appropriate. It's still really quite impressive on the upside. Nothing has really happened to question the ability of it to continue to rally. We're definitely getting a lot more institutional investors becoming active in the market, and they're becoming increasingly vociferous in trying to defend their rationale for why one should be invested. One thing we certainly know is that Bitcoin does tend to be cyclical, and it can rally very powerfully in the year after a halvening event. Well, the last halvening event was in June of last year, and since then it certainly pulled back in a violent manner during the pandemic, and didn't really do much of anything immediately after the halvening, but then it started to rally. And that's not all that different from what we had in 2016 and then all the way through 2017. The most bullish investors are betting that Bitcoin will repeat in 2021 what it did in 2017 before we get the next big or significant pullback. There's also this cyclicality in terms of three-year ranges. So when it does eventually peak, it's likely to pull back in a violent manner and then bubble around for perhaps even a couple of years before the next halvening event. It is a limited supply asset, so there are really only so many Bitcoin around, and that is one of the clearest fundamentals for the entire market. If we could think about then what's the potential for these sorts of assets, well, it's quite likely that we're not quite yet at the point in the whole cryptocurrency market where we're going to get broad adoption. But certainly institutions are taking greater positions, and more companies are offering services. So PayPal is another one of these fintech companies that had pulled back in a violent manner, three aggressive weeks on the downside, and we're starting to see some evidence of support coming through in the region of the trend mean. When we think about exactly what's going on, well, there are two potential conclusions that we might draw. The first is that these very aggressive pullbacks are inconsistencies relative to the trend up, particularly from March. And that would certainly be true. On top of that, we would have to at least give some consideration to the fact that we've had a very big move in bonds, and that has shaken the resolve of a lot of investors. The one of the most successful strategies over the last 40 years has been risk parity. So risk parity looks at an equal weighting of positions between bonds and equities, currencies and commodities, and then it looks at the volatility and tries to weight them accordingly. Well, the inverse correlation between bonds and equities has been the defining characteristic of the success of risk parity, particularly over the last few years. Now, at the moment, bonds and equities have tended to move together. Bond prices started to pull back in an aggressive manner over the course of the last week in particular, and then stocks have wobbled every time bond prices have started to come back. The other side of that equation is that every time bond prices steady, then people move in and buy the dips in equities. But as bond yields rise, then it introduces a discount rate, and it also increases the servicing costs of debts for governments. And those represent twin threats to highly levered companies. When we think about the fact that there is a substantial number of companies which are characterized as zombies, then it does represent a challenge. And that does suggest that we're going to have continued monetary and fiscal support for the economy, even as we move into a reflation. Well, that's really very bullish for stocks. It's exactly the kind of thing that can really help to people get very encouraged about what the potential is, where we have both encouraging or loose financial conditions and the potential for growth to also pick up And then with uptrends in stocks, then that is the kind of environment where you get a bull market. Of course, the background is how does all of that get paid for, and will it accelerate the question of raising interest rates? Well, central banks have said in plain English they don't want to raise interest rates. And you had, for example, in the UK this week, Rishi Sunak saying that the government would have to raise some taxes, and they avoided raising national insurance, they avoided raising personal income taxes or cutting services, but they did raise taxes on corporations. So that's an indication of where the trend is likely to be, that governments are in no way ready to risk losing an election because of raising taxes on individuals. We've already been treated to rounds of social unrest. So that's an additional point. And then when we think about, well, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to tax companies because they are a fat target. But that's not going to be enough to close deficits. And most particularly, as demand for increasing saving, or excuse me, spending persist, so there is likely to be continued upward pressure on the bond market. And yields rising is a significant headwind to continued outperformance for stocks. So it's hard to imagine that we can have both a big bull market and rising yields. But we might have it for a while longer. When we think about, particularly in the period after the financial crisis, the difference in the yield between the S&P 500 and the 10-year Treasury, it has generally been an indication that when Treasuries yield a percentage more than the S&P dividend yield, that has been a headwind for stock markets. But it has only just crossed the zero bound. So there is still potential for stocks to do reasonably well, for this mean reversion to represent a buying opportunity, at least in the near term, before the really big questions about rising bond yields have to be answered. The only way that governments are going to come through and really have a solution for this massive quantity of debt that's been produced would be to inflate it away. Well, big countries where they get to issue debt in their own currency don't default, but massive currency devaluation is certainly a stealth default. We've definitely seen a significant pullback in gold over the course of the last 6 months, and it has just about steadied in the region of $1,700 in here this week. It's been weak right across the board, and particularly in currencies which have been stronger than the US dollar, because the dollar has been one of the stronger currencies overall. It's held up better against the weaker currencies. The Brazilian real is really quite susceptible to any kind of rebound in the US dollar, and it has a lot of US dollar denominated debt. The real is testing the, or the dollar is testing the upper side of its range over the last year versus the real right now. And the Turkish lira has also broken the sequence of higher reaction lows, so that's clear support for the dollar around the 7 area. Japan is one of the most interesting countries because they have clearly activated their yield control device in here this week. The yen has depreciated significantly, and now the dollar has clearly broken the sequence of lower rally highs. And when we look at their bond yield, it has significantly contracted as it came up to test that 20 basis point level. They have said that they're going to defend the 10 basis point level, and it closed this week at 9. So Japan is still very much engaged in yield curve control. They have no interest in having a stronger currency, and they are willing to do whatever it takes. And I think that some of these central banks, they are listed on their own stock markets. So Japanese Central Bank, they printed a ton of yen in here this week, and the stock for the Bank of Japan surged higher. Japan has been quite clear that it is buying its own stock market, and they own significant quantities of stock. That makes perfect sense to me. Why not buy significant portions of income-producing companies? These companies have the potential to raise dividends in an inflationary environment and pay and eventually with retained earnings and with reinvested dividends, it's possible for the central banks to turn a profit. The Swiss Central Bank is also listed, and it has also been really quite a volatile share, because Switzerland has gone one further and it's buying big international companies as well as Swiss companies. And I think that that is one of the smartest things that any central bank can do, instead of buying the paper from their own government. Eventually, this is this monetization of debt is going to cause a problem. And we're starting to see that bond investors are willing to give some credence to the view that inflationary pressures will start to pick up, because central banks have said that they're going to do whatever it takes to create inflation. Well, that means that they're going to ensure that interest rates stay down for longer. They're not going to raise them. They're going to keep very liquid environments. One of the reasons why I think that this is more of a mean reversion than an outright top is because the yield curve is not the only indicator. The high yield spread remains really very contained at only 273 basis points. It's at the lowest level since at least 2014. If there was really a problem with solvency, with people worried about corporates, well, then high yield spreads would be trending higher. Then when we think about financial conditions, we definitely had some stress in the repo market in here this week, where the 10-year repo was one of the, or excuse me, it broke its fail rate, which is the first time that's ever happened. So there are, I think, portions of the market that are quite illiquid, and that is a warning shot. If we had to think about what are the potential catalysts for additional stimulus to come through from central banks, I can think of only two. The first would be a very significant additional deterioration in yields, which has a significant knock-on effect for stocks, and then the stock market pulling back by at least to the mean, or in the order of 20%. It was a 20% pullback that forced action back in 2018. I think 20% is certainly something that would gain the attention of central banks. So that is certainly a potential outcome. But illiquidity in the repo market would bring back into focus the argument that the Federal Reserve has a standing repo facility. As we look at financial conditions, they are still extraordinarily accommodative. So as long as that remains the case, well, it's hard to imagine that we're going to get a major market top, because we still have a lot of liquidity floating around. There has been a wonderful opportunity for corporations to source a great deal of liquidity, to issue new debt at very low levels, to refinance, and to push out the maturity wall at least another few years. So that's all positive for the stock market. as we move progressively towards more vaccinations, it's really positive for the reflation argument as well. So really the only big risk in the market today is the sectors that have become most acutely interest rate sensitive, which certainly falls into the category for the SPACs and the IPOs. And I think those individual companies need to be taken on their individual merits, because obviously some are fly-by-night charlatans and others really do have solid business models. There are certainly more big IPOs coming this year. Robinhood is going to certainly be one of those big ones. Then we can think about the outlook for innovation overall. Well, the innovation ETF pulled back really extremely violently in here this week, but it also rallied incredibly impressively. So pulling back and the sensitivity of these types of stocks to Tesla was something I was pointing out as they rallied higher, and that has certainly been true as they pulled back. But it has completed the mean reversion, so there's going to be some people that think this is a wonderful buying opportunity. And we should be thinking about exactly what do these types of funds own. Well, Tesla is obviously a big weighting, and then so is Square. And Square has been doing well because they are accepting Bitcoin. I'm just at a complete loss as to why anybody would want to own Roku. It just seems to be a commoditized service, and yet the share price has done really exceptionally well over the course of the last year, and this so far is a reasonable pullback compared to the size of the advance. Generally, after these kinds of events, what you can anticipate is you get a bounce, and then you get ranging. And how long and how, how prolonged that ranging is before it can break on the upside will start to inform us as to whether it's a top in development or whether this was simply a consolidation after a big move. I would certainly hasten to add that there are definitely companies that are not going to pass this test. There are plenty that have a runway in terms of growth. Then we can think about where is growth likely to come from over the course of the next decade. Well, it is certainly I should put this back into local currencies. I apologize for that. We can think about India, where they have this incredible demographic dividend that is likely to fuel economic activity for at least the next 20 years. We can think about some of the big countries in Africa, where they also have even better demographics. The Nigerian index has taken off in line with the oil price, and now we're also seeing some consolidation in here as well. Obviously, we've also had this incredible volatility over the course of the last year. What I find particularly interesting is that this extreme volatility in terms of volatile ranging has been a factor for a large number of emerging markets, and it's being picked up reasonably well by the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. Now, that is consolidating in the region of the upper side of that range. Then when we think about what's likely in terms of the semiconductors sector, well, the SOX index is well off its low in here today, but it's also another one of these sectors that pulled in sales from off in the future. Also, in the last couple of weeks, we've definitely seen that there is increasing demand for the kinds of machinery that build these types of semiconductors. Europe has said that they want to have their own semiconductor industry, and that they are setting a target of having built one by 2030. China wants to have the same thing, so there's likely to be increasing evidence of an arms race in the semiconductor development sector. That's probably going to be something that should benefit them over the medium term, because resource nationalization is turning into more of data nationalization, and that is likely to be the most important factor over the next decade, that there is increasing global competition, that there's an increasing willingness to invest in complete independence. So we have Bitcoin as independence. We have renewable energy is energy independence. So Bitcoin is financial independence. Then we have semiconductor independence. So countries are going to spend an incredible amount of money trying to become semiconductor independent. When we think about who are the beneficiaries from that, Samsung said this week that they're going to build, I think it was something in the order of $13 billion to build a manufacturing center in the USA. But the CEO of Siemens has, or Samsung, I should say, has also said that if China needs help with building manufacturing capacity for semiconductors, then Samsung will help them as well. Of course, Samsung is a lot closer in proximity to China than the ASML is in the Netherlands. So these are, I think, probably going to be significant factors, but no question, Samsung is still in a reversionary process, and this ranging phase could last a while. There's no question that this sector has pulled sales forward from the future. So the big performers last year were the cloud companies, the semiconductors. Then it was companies like, and I will just put up the cloud computing chart. But then it was also companies like Zoom or DocuSign that really did well. They're all going to have a more difficult time growing at the same point or the same pace, so they're due consolidation. We could be looking at a multi-month consolidation, and that's of course assuming that bond yields don't continue to trend higher in aggressive manners. When we think about what are the sectors that have got runway for growth, well, if we're moving towards more of the steeper yield curve environment, then that's very beneficial for banks. And the S&P 500 Banks Index is now right in the region of its peaks from 2018 and 19. The European banks sector, and that's including the non-euro portion of the financial sector in Europe, has also continued to rebound, and it pushed higher again in here today. So it's pushing now back up into that overhead trading range. Even when we think about the Japanese banks, which have been out in the cold for an awfully long time, they benefit. And there's probably no country will benefit more from a return to an inflationary bias. The Nikkei has been pausing around the 30,000 level, but I think it's probably not much more than a consolidation. So it's banks, energy, commodities, pharmaceuticals, and then the portions of the technology sector that have dividends, that have solid income or income streams, they're all likely to do better as we move into a reflationary environment. Then we can think about the fact that the small caps have done exceptionally well, and they were well off the lows in here today. We're due consolidation. We have a short-term overbought condition. I don't think it would be unreasonable to see at least some consolidation, but then we can think about the relative performance, and the small caps have rebounded from lows last seen almost a decade ago. It's been a very lengthy period of time when technology has outperformed. This ratio looks eerily similar to the value growth ETF. We're seeing a significant rebound from the lows of this ratio back in early 2000, which was the climax of the last big move in technology. When we think about the technology sector, it's incredibly broad. There is still this incredible pace of technological innovation. And I think that as we move into more of an inflationary environment, then the hurdle for innovation is going to become harder to achieve. It means that there will be fewer companies that will do well. And the bigger companies will benefit because they have the capital. And these companies like Google, which has got a long record of investing in innovation and has ample resources, are in a very strong position relative to capital-hungry companies that are completely reliant on low interest rates. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.